Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I am enthralled by one of the local newspaper's headlines today.
Yeah.
Let me read it to you as it is. Give Dad the gift of meat. And that's really the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it?
I like that headline. Now, I have to say, I know that you grabbed this paper on your way in really quickly, but did you read the paper?
I just saw the inside of it, yes. Yes.
Did you see that it mentions our place?
I did not, but I saw that.
It does. Stage Left will be offering their wood-grilled steak menu for brunch and dinner.
Oh, how nice. I didn't even see that. That's funny.
I knew you didn't see that when you said, did you see this?
That's funny. Something else is in the newspaper that we have to mention, and one of the great icons of New Jersey dining is going to be celebrating their 25th anniversary this year.
Frog and the Peach.
A restaurant called the Frog and the Peach, and it's in the same paper that Give Your Dad the Gift of Meat is the headline for. But anyway, the Frog and the Peach celebrating their 25th anniversary.
That's quite an achievement.
I'll tell you, and this is what I tell people all the time. Think of any restaurant you can, almost anywhere in the world, but certainly in the United States. Think of a restaurant that's serving the same type of cuisine that they were serving 25 years ago.
Right.
And now think of how many of them there are.
Are 20 years old or
more. Are 20 years old or more.
Especially on the high end.
Okay.
Which is even harder to say.
And the answer is...
Very few.
I can't think of one that's...
Ryland Inn, Fromagerie, you know, they're all...
They've all changed. They've either changed hands, changed ownership, or completely changed the style of food.
Or closed.
Yeah. And so it is a huge credit to the owners of the Frog and the Peach that for 25 years they have been at the top of their game.
Jim Black and Betsy Alger. And actually, Betsy is the chairwoman of the New Jersey Restaurant Association, the first woman to hold that post, which is a pretty important post, which is run by has been run for years with the executive director or the president, used to be called the executive director, another powerful woman in the really talented woman in the restaurant business in New Jersey, a woman named Deborah Dowdell. New Jersey Restaurant Association is a pretty amazing resource. And when Deborah took it over, God, about when we opened our first restaurant.
Oh, it's a long time ago.
It wasn't that important or relevant. It was kind of a social club, but they weren't very effective. And boy, with Deborah at the helm, they're effective, and Betsy's doing a great job. And, you know, it's funny. I do remember because, you know, Mark and I, it wasn't my first restaurant job, but it was my second restaurant job. And
it was probably my third or fourth, yeah.
And it's where we worked together and really honed our skills. And it's funny, I remember their 10th anniversary when we were 4 years old, or however. Mm-hmm. No, was their 10th anniversary when we were just a couple of years
old? We were just a year or two old, yeah.
Because right. I started working at the Frog and the Peach when they were 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I started working there in 86.
You're old.
Oh, my
so
God.
So what that means
I?
Is you're old.
Oh, yeah, that's what this roundabout circuitous route has come back to. I'm old. But, you know, I started working there when they were 3 years old. I worked there for 6 years. And I remember we had only been open a year when they celebrated their 10th anniversary. And I said to myself, 10 years. Do you think, you know, if we can make it for 10 years, and we're now in business 16 years.
Unbelievable.
And the difference between 16 and 25 is not as great as the difference between 1 and 10. So we're catching up.
That's true. But I want to go back to the headline that drew me here.
Yeah.
Give Dad the Gift of Meat. I want to complain. As a father, I want to complain. I want to complain about Father's Day.
Why?
Because it is the most unfair of holidays.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Okay.
It applies to you, but it doesn't apply to others.
For Mother's Day, what do I do?
You cook for your wife.
I cook for my wife, or I take her out to dinner, or we do something. I make her breakfast in bed, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
For Father's Day, what do we do?
Well, you get to grill.
I get to cook for the whole family again.
All right, but for guys who aren't in the restaurant,
they love
to grill.
Oh, okay. I guess I didn't say I don't like it. I didn't say it's not fun. I just said it's unfair.
Yeah, what I like about by the way, we should point out that the article is in our very local paper, the Home News, the Central Jersey paper, which is in New Brunswick. But what if you look at the rest of the article, what this says is it gives you the names of restaurants that are serving steak on Father's Day, and it's suggesting that, and since we own one of those, we wholeheartedly support you bringing your dad out. But, yeah, you know, the whole barbecue in the backyard on Father's Day.
It's just wrong. It's just wrong.
I think a lot of guys like it, but I do support the take your dad to a steakhouse on Father's Day. And we may as well mention the restaurants as long as we're doing this. There's talking about here in Jersey, of course, this is local if you're listening outside Jersey. Maybe
sorry.
It won't mean as much to you. But there's the Liberty House restaurant, which is owned by our friend Frank Cretella, right on Liberty.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. Look, it's right in the Liberty State Park in Jersey City.
Overlooks the Statue of Liberty. Really, it looks pretty close.
All of New York Harbor, and you can actually get a ferry there from Manhattan if you want, and if you come from Jersey. It's just beautiful. I jog by it in the morning. Montville Inn, don't know much about it, but they have a barbecue.
Jogs by it in the morning twice a year, whether he needs it or not.
Whatever, I should jog. If I make it to the Liberty House, it's time to turn around and go home. There's the Stone House at Sterling Ridge. There's Stage Left, of course. There's a Pierre's.
And a place I've never been to, but it certainly has caught my attention.
The Landslide Saloon's annual pig roast and family fun day.
Boy, it's got my attention. It's got my attention.
A pig roast.
Roast and family fun day. Come on, what could be better for Father's Day?
That it's in on Interstate 78. The Landslide Saloon is a half mile up Jugtown Mountain. Well, that sounds like fun in itself right there, doesn't it? I didn't know we had a Jugtown Mountain. I thought it was familiar with all the mountains in the state of New Jersey. If you want to check that out, you can go to mycentraljersey.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Georgianne Brennan. She is a prolific food journalist and cookbook author. She's published over 30 cookbooks, and she's gotten the James Beard Award, the Julia Child Cookbook Award, and she's here to discuss A Pig in Provence, a memoir of her relocation to the French region.
Georgianne, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
The book, wonderful. You've written so many books before. How is this book different from the others you've written?
Well, this book is really, you know, kind of what we call a creative nonfiction, which means that, you know, some of the conversations are as I remember them. They may or may not be totally accurate. So this is...
Sounds basically like every conversation I've ever had.
Well, there you go. So the other books that I have written have been cookbooks, where the opportunity to write prose is in the headnotes, the introductions to the recipe, whereas this book, you know, people have told me that it reads like a novel with recipes.
You know, that's a trend that we're seeing more and more. I think in cookbooks you see today what people yearn for, and what good cookbook authors do is they seek to contextualize the recipes in the book. And I think that when people write food-centric memoirs or fiction, they feel compelled to include some recipes. Do you see that as a trend in writing about food?
I do. I see it more and more, and sometimes I feel that the recipes are stuck in kind of gratuitously, you know, with an editor that says, hey, we need some recipes in here, you know, put some recipes in. And other times, in the best examples, they work like embedded illustrations. You know, instead of photographs, there's a recipe that illustrates, you know, what the memoirist is writing about. And hopefully that's what mine have done. That was certainly the intent.
Well, especially for a food food professional, I think that sometimes a recipe does tell more than what a picture might.
I think you're right. And the way that recipe is written and what it reflects about what the food person is saying, the kind of ingredient that's being used, it can be very meaningful.
Well, it's hard to write about France. I mean, even if you look at, you know, the expatriate writers of the 30s, you know, food and wine invariably found itself mentioned, at least in their works of fiction. But it's really impossible to write truly about France, and especially about Provence, without writing about the food, isn't it? I mean, you can't write about the culture without writing about the food.
Yeah, no, you can't. And that's, you know, I think that's one of the great things about France and Provence in particular. And I often tell people, I don't know when anyone really works. It seems like we're either shopping for food or sitting over a long lunch or under a tree having an aperitif, getting ready for dinner.
I've been to France. I've often thought the same thing. I'm like, well, they're on a strike half the time, and I'm like, what are you on strike from? I don't see you working.
You know the irony for both of you is I've actually worked in France and wondered the exact same thing.
So it really is, as you said, you can't write about that culture without writing about food and wine because it's just so deeply embedded. And I think that people there really enjoy it. You know, life is about the simple pleasures of life. It is not about your job title and how many hours you work. So it's a very different...
You know what's funny though, and this I have to say is true. There, as you know, we all as restaurateurs, we have what is a well earned reputation for working many many hours. It seems to me that the hardest working people in France are the people in the restaurant business.
I would suspect you're right.
Well, and I think that's a country with its values screwed on straight. Now, I would say let's talk specifically about your book and about Provence. I think if you had to boil your book down to one word, if you said, okay, you get one word out of this book, what would be the word? I would say the word would be garlic. What would you say the word would be?
Oh.
Did I hit it closely?
Garlic is pretty close. You know, southern France is, there's just all these wonderful flavors and scents, but whether one word would be garlic, or would it be olive oil, or would it be rosé wine, or goat cheese?
One of the things that I loved about your book is how it really points out that food in Provence is not necessarily the French food that you've heard about or if you visited Paris,
what you had.
It's very different. The country food of Provence. Provence is very far south of Paris, and the food has a much more Mediterranean bent than I think than a lot of Americans realize.
I think you're absolutely right. And actually, my daughter Ethel, who's in the book as a child at 2 and a half when we first moved to Provence, is now married to not just a Frenchman but a Parisian. And he was really kind of reluctant to travel with her back to Provence to see her old friends because, kind of considered Provence as the back of beyond and,
provincial, as it were.
Exactly. And we think of it as this fabulous, glorious Mediterranean place. You're really right. The food is really Mediterranean food. It is not the food of France that we as Americans have come to think of as French food.
Well, but increasingly we are, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Georgianne Brennan about the Provence and the foods of Provence and the life in Provence and her memoir. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and 3 world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport, there's a direct train from New Brunswick, and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're talking today with Georgianne Brennan. Her book is A Pig in Provence, and you can find out more about it on our website. You can even pick it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Georgianne, this is a memoir of Provence. When Mark and I only were in that region once together, and we went in the dead of winter, it was a wine buying trip, it was all business, and the Mistral was blowing as we, you know, came down from the Rhone Valley. But Provence in the summertime has its own smells, its own light, it's really a different world, isn't it?
It is. And I think we think of the Impressionists who came south and discovered and painted that light, and you always think, oh, it's not true. And every time I return to Provence, I think, probably just me imagining it, you know, over-romanticizing. But I tell you, I come back in that light, and it's, you know, it's like maybe summertime, and it's 8:30, and there's this lavender glow that casts over the valley where my house is and across the vineyards and turns the wheat field to just this brilliant glowing white. And I just practically swoon. It's so beautiful.
You know, there are certain places in the world that just have their own light. Long Island, out in outer Long Island, has a certain light to it. Certainly Miami has its own light, and these places are usually surrounded by water, have a lot of water of one sort or another. And Provence and southern France definitely has its own light.
And let me just share something. If you go someplace and it makes you feel that way, it is romantic.
Right.
Okay, you haven't over-romanticized it.
Right.
It is indeed romantic.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, actually, that does sort of straighten something up. It is. You're right. Thank you.
And just we're gonna take a break and we're gonna listen to the news in just a moment. But I hope you'll stick with us and come back on the other side of the news. But how one eats in Provence is sort of a leisurely way to eat. It's not as much of a production as, say, a grand meal in Paris. Would you say that's correct?
I would really say that that's true. There's the pleasure of the table is the main thing. So if you're only having, you know, maybe and radishes and butter, a little salt, it'll be really savored and enjoyed. And then you might just have a bowl of ratatouille, but it's not just tossed on the table. Each thing is measured, I think, with care and with affection for where the ingredients came from and how they were prepared.
Well, when we come back after the news, we're going to talk more with Georgia and Brennan about a pig in Provence, and we're going to bring into this pastoral setting what happens with pigs in Provence, and it's not great for the pig, I'll be honest with you. We're going to talk about that and how the pig can wind up on your table. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Georgianne Brennan's most recent book is A Pig in Provence. It's a memoir of her experiences in the region. Let's talk. Let's get to the meat of the matter, as it were, and talk about the pig in Provence. The pigs in Provence are not so much pets as dinner, and you got pretty involved in turning the animal into, well, the dinner. Want to talk to us about that?
Sure. My husband and young daughter and I first went to Provence in 1970 and bought a farmhouse there deep in the rural countryside, and acquired a herd of goats and learned to make goat's milk cheese and sold it. And one of our French neighbors said, oh, well, you've got these goats and, you know, you need to have a pig. I thought, well, I don't know what having a pig has to do with having goats. And he explained that one of the byproducts of the cheese is the whey, you know, curds and whey, and that the whey was full of protein, and that traditionally in Provence, the whey was mixed with the bran and other products that the pigs were fed, and it was really good and made this wonderful meat. So we got a pig and named her Lucretia.
Don't name your pig.
Well, this is different, though, because Lucretia was a sow, and her job wasn't so much to turn into charcuterie and pâté mm-hmm. as it was to have several litters a year of little piglets.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sold the piglets to the local people around the region who then raised their little piglets to make charcuterie and pâté.
Uh-huh.
So it's quite the adventure.
Well, now, you mentioned in the story of the pig, we mentioned the story of your goats and your goat cheese. Goats are actually, they're kind of, they have a mind of their own. They're somewhat, they're not, that's not a Labrador retriever,
oh,
right?
They're not, they're, you bet.
Talk to us about coming into the farming of goats in Provence as an American.
Well, my first husband that I went to France with had a degree in animal husbandry from UC Davis in California. So he had a background in the care and feeding and breeding and so forth of animals. So we felt a little bit, you know, knowledgeable about there, not entirely as crazy as it seemed. But the goats that were available were not, you know, milking dairy goats, but these were kind of the semi-wild goats that traveled with the shepherds as they took the sheep on the Transhumance from the valleys to the high mountains. So these goats really did have a mind of their own. We named them all, and they definitely were pets, but they didn't normally do what you told them unless you were feeding them. Then they were pretty obedient.
There's a great story in your book about your goat anchors. Will you tell
us
about
that? Yeah, you have to share with them.
I have to share the goat anchor story.
Please. I only wish I could see. In the movie, that's going to be a critical scene.
It will be a great scene.
Thank you. I think it's a brilliant scene. And I kind of see Johnny Depp as chasing them around.
Yeah. So talk to us about your goat anchors.
The goat anchors. Well, one of the things that the goats wanted to do was roam around and range free and, you know, eat everything inside, including the vineyards and the orchards.
And goats will eat basically everything.
Yeah, definitely. They're good for that. So we had to control them somehow. And, you know, we didn't have time to build a pen, so we thought we'll anchor them. So we got tires. And fill the tire. We made cement and filled the tires with cement, and then attached these to the goat's collars with these, you know, like kind of like leashes. And so those were the anchors. But that didn't stop them. So there was this hysterical. I mean, it wasn't funny at the time. It is now, of this herd of goats. I think we probably had about 18 at the time, bouncing, you know, running down the hill toward the wheat field with the tires dragging along behind them.
The cement-filled tires dragging along.
The cement-filled tires. And, of course, the postman loved to come to our house every day. You know, he'd bring a little croissant for my daughter and chit-chat and then run back up to the bar that was owned by his brother and tell everyone what the Americans were doing.
Goats are tougher than they look.
It is a little like a Chevy Chase movie. The other thing that happens in Provence a lot is hunting for mushrooms,
foraging.
And hunting for truffles,
mm-hmm.
and foraging from what's there naturally. The relationship with wild food in Provence is a little different than most.
Certainly here in the United States, although I have to say my grandfather was a mushroom hunter. He would
in Brooklyn, New York.
Well, he'd go to upstate New York and go mushroom hunting.
Talk to us about mushroom hunting and truffle hunting in Provence.
Well, it is the most fun thing to do. And when I discovered, it's always something intriguing about mushrooms. You know, if you've read fairy tales and their toadstools, and they're kind of featured in all of that. So when I found out from one of my neighbors, Georgette, that they were edible and that you could find them and bring them back and cook them, it is like going on a treasure hunt.
Mm.
And I realized that two things happened to me. One, I realized how competitive I can be when you're hunting those mushrooms. I said, no, that's mine. And the other thing is that I feel like I have this kind of latent hunter-gatherer gene because I love nothing better than going out and foraging for things. The wild asparagus, the wild herbs, wild garlic, and, you know, the mushrooms, of course.
Now,
and the truffles are a different story, though.
Well, I will tell you, and there is a certain gratification that you get from planting, caring for something, and harvesting that. There's a certain gratification you get from that. But when you talk about, and I've never actually mushroom hunted, but there's a certain gratification that you get from foraging, from going out into the woods, finding a wild blueberry bush right at the height of blueberry season, and eating all the blueberries off of it,
or
gathering all the blueberries off of it and bringing half of them home. There's a certain gratification to just kind of finding something like that out in the wild.
I so agree with you. Don't you just that sense of exhilaration that I found it, and then it's, and there's nothing as good, like you say, as like a wild berry, and it's just like, oh, this is the meaning of life, right?
Well, yeah, I'm sure it's not that far that far away from the way a thief feels when he's actually stolen something, you know.
Oh, maybe.
Well, and wild food is often very different. Like wild strawberries are very different than their cultivated cousins. So when you would forage for food out there, but you know, if this were, even if they were as widely available around here, it would only be your very dedicated foodie, a very small percentage of the population that would consider going out and doing that. Do most people do that in Provence?
Yes, they do.
Isn't that wild?
It's really part
of the culture.
And one of the funny things is when it's mushroom season, people want everybody to know how many mushrooms they've got. So they'll sit in front of their door trimming them.
Oh, that's great.
So everybody can see them. Or they'll set up their cook stove right in their little terrace or their patio, and really it's completely showing off. And if their cars are parked near the forest, then they put their buckets full of mushrooms out by their car and kind of stand there and chat for a while.
That's tremendous. Now,
just soaking up the sunshine, don't mind me.
Oh, these old things? Now, one of the other things, one of the other food items from...
Just one last thing about mushrooms. We actually, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. In the restaurant, there is a picture of my grandfather after one of these mushroom foraging expeditions. And what I'll tell you is there is a picture of my grandfather smiling, standing in front of what has got to be a mushroom that is 2.5 feet across.
Wow.
And he's got this big grin on his face. Oh. And what I'm going to tell you is, it is the only picture I own of my grandfather smiling.
I could completely believe it.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk more with Georgianne Brennan about her book and her experiences in Provence. You can find out more about her book at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're having a lovely conversation today with Georgianne Brennan. Her book, A Pig in Provence, is a memoir of her experiences in the region. Now, one of the other things that we find when we're in the south of France a lot is that bouillabaisse originally comes from Provence, right?
Right.
Talk to us about bouillabaisse and its historical, classical
iteration. As we know it and how it probably should be known.
Well, you know, as with any traditional classical dish, there's, 14 different right versions and then the wrong versions, and nobody can agree on anything. But over the years in Marseille, right along the coast, there has evolved a certain classical definition, and you start with the bones and the heads and the small little fish that you know, that all obviously from the Mediterranean, and a certain kind of little crab called saviul, and then olive oil and garlic and wild fennel stalks and a little bit of fennel pollen if it's that time of year. And you cook all that down with some tomato and onion, the garlic, of course, and then you run it through a sieve so that there's just this, you begin with the stock that's made of all of those things. And then different fish are poached in it and mussels, and then it's served with a toast that's been heated, not grilled, just heated, and then rubbed with olive oil and garlic, and then a roux, or kind of a red pepper sauce. You get a bowl with the broth, and then the toast, and then spoonfuls of this wonderful spicy red pepper sauce. And that's your first course. And then the fish, some of it filleted, and then some of it whole, comes to the table. So that's kind of the purest of pure versions. And then in Toulon, you know, whatever it is, 30 miles away maybe, they insist that it have potatoes. So then the potatoes get cooked in the broth, and that's part of it as well. I think there's some saffron in it, too. And but what we typically see is a mass of a lot of shellfish and lobsters, and that was a Parisian invention to put those lobsters in, and so on and so forth.
And so for the real bouillabaisse, it has to be, you know, and it's funny, the bouillabaisse you speak of, just, I don't know, it speaks to me of the whole culture of Provence and how you would have food there, sort of leisurely over time, you know, in multiple courses and just absolutely, you know, delicious, spread out, and not one big extravaganza.
And not too fussy at the same time.
Right, not too fussy and spread out. And you know, one of the best restaurant bouillabaisses that I had was outside of Marseille on the Calanques, they're called, and they're these deep cliffs that are cut into the coast. And to get there, you had to call ahead to open the gate because they protect the environment from just too much random stuff going on. And there are these old cottages there that don't have electricity, and they're just lit by gas lamps. And then you wind out to this restaurant with the weird name of Le Lunch, the lunch. Who knows why? And it's this ugly white cement building. But then you see the beautiful glow of candlelight, white tablecloths, flowers, all along, you know, really set out over the sea. The sea's lapping against it. And then they brought the exact meal that I described to you. And we had it with bottles of white cassis wine from down the road. And it was out of this world.
Cassis Blanc. That sounds like a wonderful, wonderful experience and meal. And getting
and just for our listeners, cassis, the wine is not the same as cassis, the liqueur. They're completely different.
And
thank you.
And you can't find cassis around too often. We get one every once in a while in the restaurant. Around this time of year, we'll get some again. And the Domaine du Bagnol, I think you can find in this country. Mm-hmm. But it's worth seeking out.
Oh, it's just, you know, that wine chilled, it just puts you on the Riviera.
Yeah, really.
Right?
Well, now, there's another local specialty, of course, that you talk about in your book is snails, right? I mean, snails are really important to Provençal cuisine. Talk to us about them.
Well, the snails, particularly, you know, when I first went there in the 70s and then on into the snails were, everybody went hunting for snails, just like we were talking about hunting for mushrooms. When it was snail time, after the rain, people were out gathering the snails. You have buckets and, and then they put them in these little cages, wire cages that you can still find in some of the, you know, brocante, flea market kind of places. And then they would feed them wild thyme, which grew everywhere, and bran. Or a type of cornmeal to cleanse them, and you keep them for 15 days, and then you boil them and you do all these various things, and then they'd serve them with different sauces, more so than the escargot bourguignon with the garlic and the pepper.
Right.
And the
your implication is that that doesn't happen as often as it used to. People don't hunt for snails anymore like they did.
Well, I think that one of the things that has happened is that with the more intensive agriculture and with some of the modern products, you know, the fertilizers and chemicals, that there's just not the abundance of snails that there used to be.
Hmm.
And their records nearby where I live, of the Romans having a limacière, which is basically a raising snails. So it goes way, way back to Roman and probably pre-Roman, actually pre-Roman.
We need some snail breeders out there.
Well, but it's amazing, you know, when you mess with the environment, you know, little things like this start to happen, and it's a system, and we need to be very, very careful with our planet. Hey, Georgianne, we have to leave it there, but your book is wonderful, and I want to thank you for coming on the show to talk with us about it.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I enjoyed the show.
Really a pleasure.
And if you'd like to enjoy the book as well, you can pick it up. We recommend it. It's called A Pig in Provence. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:50. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey.
You know, Georgianne mentioned a trick that the people who collected the snails did with where they would feed it cornmeal and bran and things like that in order to to cleanse itself. Actually, a trick that you can use my aunt, my mother, my grandmother always used when we would go clamming or mussling, in order to make sure that the grit comes out of the clams or the mussels, we would, when we soak them in salt water, and put cornmeal into the salt water, and what would happen is the clams will take in the cornmeal and spit out all that dirt and soot and all that other stuff from the murky sea bottom, and you just need to leave them in there for, let's say, an hour or 2 hours, and they'll clean themselves right out and really make a much more pleasurable experience than, you know, that will help clean all that grit and stuff out of
you
the,
know,
out of the
people
snails.
Often sometimes will
not
will,
snails mussels and clams.
People will often use crayfish, and I've seen restaurants even do live crayfish wrong, because crayfish live in the mud, and if you purge your crayfish before you cook them, if you're cooking whole crayfish in the shell, makes for a much better crayfish. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that, since crayfish are freshwater, you drop them in salt water, and they'll then purge themselves, and you'll see this murky water that you then have clean crayfish to use.
Yeah, better to have the murky water and the clean crayfish.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of murkying the water and cleaning the crayfish.
The way most restaurants purchase crayfish, though, when they get them, is they are already shelled and in a plastic bag. And
that's so true. A lot of people buy them like that.
That's the cheapest way to do it.
And the easiest way.
But a few restaurants I have seen go for the crayfish in the shell, which, frankly, as a diner, I don't know, it's too much of a pain for me to eat. And it's nice.
I don't know. In the right place, in the right setting. You know, I like to sometimes play with my food a little bit.
Yeah, whatever. Anyway, I get it. I get the appeal. But if you're doing that as a
restaurateur... I get it, appeal.
If you do that as a restaurateur, you have to be careful. Or as a home cook, you can always... And the glory about our modern age is you go on the internet and you look at how to prepare fresh stuff. Mm-hmm. And you'll see little tricks like that can really be important. Anyway, the book of Pig in Provence, if you've never been to Provence, it's wonderful to read about this seemingly mythical place that's not. And if you've been there, this is a way to bring yourself back. I really enjoyed it a great deal. Like, I hope that you've enjoyed this last hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.